Customer first is a phrase every corporate executive utters, but what does it really mean? Much like digital transformation, it depends on the context. The context of the core business is fundamentally different from that of a new venture. Corporate management is well schooled in how to efficiently extract more cash out of the core business, but the tried and true principles of managing the core are at best counterproductive and at worst, value destroying when applied to the exploratory business venture. As a result, many new business ventures are asked to scale to revenue before they are fully mature. There is a technological or product solution, but no clarity on how to create a repeatable business model from solving a customer problem. This is the maturity gap. This maturity gap can be closed by adopting customer-first practices of customer discovery, customer validation, and maturity assessment. In today's episode of the Corporate Explorer series brought to you by Wazoku, we describe these practices and their applications. We are joined by the perfect person to tell us about this. He is co-author of the Corporate Explorer Fieldbook, former head of Bosch Innovation Consulting for Asia Pacific, and now director of corporate ventures for Mann and Hummel, Michael Nichols. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to discussing this.
It's great to have you on the show, Michael. And before we get started, I have to mention our brilliant sponsor, Wazoku. Many of our audience have asked what the name actually means. It's not an easy-to-Google name. It's Swahili, and Wazoku means great idea. And the Wazoku team are advocates of everyday innovation and strive to make innovation a part of everyone's role in every organization. Recently, Wazoku acquired Innocentive, Change in Colombia, Mindpool, Idea Drop, and most recently, Poster Lab. But let's get started with inside-out innovation and the cycle and the limitations of this model. Maybe you'll tell us about what this is, Michael, and then I'll show on the screen for those people watching us on YouTube the inside-out cycle.
Typically, when you're talking about inside-out innovation, you're not talking about core business innovation, right? Because core business innovation is typically generated by R&D. It's not the breakthrough type of R&D, but it's usually advanced engineering, where you're looking to make incremental improvements to an existing model, existing technology. Think of it as Gen 1, Gen 2, Gen 3 type innovation in product launches. What we're really talking about is generating the equivalent of a startup inside of a corporation or a venture, if you'd like to categorize it that way. So if you generate one of these ventures inside of a corporation, that's called inside-out innovation as opposed to the other way of innovating, which is outside-in. I actually don't like the terms inside-out and outside-in because I think innovation is just innovation. It's always a combination of internal resources and external, whether you're partnering or purchasing from the value chain. It's always trying to figure out how to start a venture by putting that value chain together into a venture that can repeat and scale. But you typically do it in a corporation with your existing personnel. So you will generate projects internally at the corporation. At Bosch, we were lucky to have project teams on these teams that would have a venture idea. And then we would put them through a program to validate that idea. A typical incubation type program is called the Bosch Accelerator. And there, yeah, it starts on the inside with the idea, but immediately you have to go outside and validate it with actual customers. So when we're talking about inside out innovation, that's exactly what we're talking about. We could probably get into a really big session about what the challenges of inside out innovation are, but starting at the very high level, it already starts at what strategy are you pursuing? Is there a defined strategy? And if you're committing to innovation topics outside of the core business, what are they? Make them well defined. Commit resources up front. They're often not committed up front. And so you end up in the situation where you're validating a business where it's not sure that you'll be funded all the way to the end. And one of the ways I point out this dilemma is to imagine the innovation funnel, right? You have lots of ideas coming into the front. And then as you validate those ideas, whether it's in venture capital outside of a corporation or inside, you eventually pare them down to the few that are interesting. Now, in corporate, what's interesting, we spend lots of money at the front of the funnel, right? On the ideation part, on what I would call the theatrics of innovation, the mimicry of innovation. Lots of money available there. And ironically, as you validate the venture and you start testing, not the technology, there's always money for technology in corporations, but as you start doing the innovation piece, the go-to-market, the business modeling piece, there's almost no money there. That's one of the interesting challenges. So that's why I say you have to commit to fund that up front. Now, in the startup world, which I'm now in, nobody gives you money for an idea. Nobody cares about the theatrics. And as you validate on the market and produce actual evidence of repeatability, scalability, and that you're actually solving a real problem, there's almost infinite money available. Right? There are people throwing money at you in the equity markets, et cetera. So that's already one of the challenges of inside out innovation, is to properly strategically frame it and then fund it accordingly as you would get the type of funding out in the venture world. Except that we seem to in corporate not understand that the funding is not on the theatrical part, on the ideation part. And most ideas are not good ideas in their original formulation. They only become good as you validate them in the market. And then you scale investment. And I know Andy Benz is a big proponent of this. Scale investment as you learn. Don't do it before you learn, because that's the biggest risk you can take of all. So that's one of the major issues up front when you're talking about corporate innovation, is to properly strategically frame them and then commit to the process of the innovation funnel and then scaling as you learn, funding as you learn, but making sure that budget's there before you do it, because corporates, unlike VC, they're on a yearly budgeting cycle normally. And if you don't hit them at the right point, there's just no money. And often you'll hear later, for some reason, there's no money available, even though you've got real customer traction.
You've whet the appetite of so many of our audience, Michael. I'm going to show on the screen the innovation cycle. I'd love you to take our audience through inside out innovation cycle.
So keep in mind here, what we're talking about is exploratory type innovation that's beyond the core business. And so if you just start at the top, almost every core business model over time, it's just, I think, the nature of things in the world, will come under threat from competition. Value propositions erode. One of the examples I like to give is Harley Davidson. Harley Davidson's customers are literally dying, their customer segment, right? So what will they do to replace them and create value propositions for the generations that could replace their existing segments where it's ostensibly shrinking, right? So businesses have to innovate to stay in the game. And they can do that, as we said, in the core business with incremental, or they can do it in the exploratory way where it's not transformation that you need, it's new business models. You need new business models that scale and repeat. So it starts there, but this is where the gap already starts. The way that corporate typically addresses that, if you just move on, is they mistake invention for innovation. They start by creating a thing. So they're creating a technology usually. I won't even say a product. So they start this exploratory innovation assuming something you cannot assume. They assume that the customer problem is actually known. And even if you talk to your salespeople to get the input, it's not usually the kind of confirmation that you would want when you're doing a venture. It's confirmation from the core business, not from this exploratory segments, right? The new segments, the new value propositions. So we mistake that. We dump millions and millions into innovation or invention. And then while this worked in the core, and Germans have a nice phrase for this, you could throw that invention, the baby, over the fence, right? To advanced technology or a product development team. The idea there is that they make it into a more mature product, right? And then after that, if you've done that, it's usually focusing more on the features, the tech feasibility. You hand it over from advanced technology after having done some initial PO, proofs of concept pilots with a few customers. You try to hand it over to the sales team of the core business unit, and that's where the gap ultimately is. Because you've actually just completed a thing without any of the validation of the customer or the value proposition. It's all been assumed. And so when we talk about the gap coming up, the biggest challenge of this type of innovation. It's that transferring that thing that you've created to a sales unit that is not trained to do the type of validation of the customers that we talk about in the venture world. They're trained to be a machine, right? To put new products into the machine, sell them to existing customers and existing business models with existing channels. The moment that the thing that you created deviates, then you've created massive uncertainty. You've created actually a cost for these sales teams and business development teams. They actually have to go out and validate this thing, and they don't know how, and it costs them money. And what ends up happening is these inventions just sit on the shelf. And I say probably rightly, right? They're not, these teams are not meant to take these uncertain things and go sell them. And if they did, it might actually end up damaging the idea anyway. And usually the early formulation of the market's a niche. So they won't even be interested to sell it. And even things where we could add a SaaS model to our existing hardware. If your sales teams don't know how to sell SaaS, if they haven't been selling SaaS, then it's going to fail because they may not even be incentivized to sell that on top of hardware. So this to me is exactly where the biggest problems in corporate innovation happen. It's the handover of this thing, the technology, to the business units where the validation hasn't been done. And when I wrote about customer first, I meant if you could put the customer first already back at R&D, validate that the thing you're building is actually needed by a significant segment of customers, then you might improve that handover conversion rate to the sales teams and business development teams. Because without that, without a validation of the business model, they won't be able to do anything with it. So that's what we really mean by this cycle. It's actually a vicious cycle that we keep repeating. And you can find a study for everything, but there are studies out there that show that the return on R&D is going down. And I suspect it's particularly at companies where they need to alter their business model, but they don't know how to validate new business models. They only know how to plug new things into their existing system. So that's what's meant by that cycle. And of course, the results are disappointing when you realize you have not validated the thing you're handing over.
It's such a huge challenge for innovators, for people like you who are driving innovation with inside organizations, for our corporate explorers who listen to this show, who are working away diligently, creating something new, and they don't think about what happens if they actually get to success and they have something to hand over. And then we often, I've been that person, you blame the sales team. But the sales team are incentivized to sell something that's often more expensive as well. So if you think about a new digital business model, it's usually a cheaper sale, or it could be a disruptive product and you've built it from within. Sure, it's no wonder the sales team don't want to sell it, because maybe their commission's a tenth of what they got for the other thing. Maybe you have some ideas on that, something from your own experience.
You described it perfectly. It's not only that it's cheaper. It's often that you might have to talk to a different part of the company you're selling to sell software. Maybe you're not hitting the CapEx budget. Maybe you're hitting the OpEx budget, right? And then it's not exactly clear what the value proposition of that software is. And the salespeople are deathly afraid of a bug being in your software, right? And rightly so. They have not, the expectation, particularly in automotive where Bosch is and where my current company is, that you come to the customer with a perfectly validated technical product, right? It's gone through every quality assurance imaginable. There are no bugs. And to ask them to sell software where the mentality is quite different, it's okay to have a bug. Microsoft is nothing but bugs and fixing them, right? So the mentality is just different. They don't want to put that in front of a customer where they might disappoint them. So it starts with the business model itself. They may be in the wrong channel to sell software, and then they don't understand the product. They don't understand how to sell it. So what I've seen companies experiment with is hire new people with new incentives to do that. I think this is probably the right way. Otherwise, you end up, you didn't say the word, but in this situation where there's resentment from the sales team and from the innovation team, which is not helpful. So it's a system problem, not a people problem. The people are just responding to their respective incentives. So setting up a separate sales department, maybe does software plus hardware, is smarter than trying to force it into your existing channels. Now, that's frustrating. That's frustrating because the advantage of being in corporate is your scale and your channels. It's the most valuable thing you have. And if you can't take advantage of that, even as an inside out team, sounds insane. You're in the corporation, yet you cannot take full advantage of their channels. That's the frustrating part, but it's also very understandable. And it requires that we think about, and this is why I like the work of O'Reilly and Tushman, it's actually an organizational problem. It's not a tech problem, although maybe there are issues in the software I just mentioned, but it's the fact that the sales organization is not set up to validate these types of models, and they don't even have the funding available to do the work necessary. So I hate to say it's nobody's fault. I do think it starts all the way at the top of the company, that when we start with buzzwords often, like IoT, AI is the new one these days, software-enabled business models, software-defined vehicles, the leadership has to commit already at the buzzword level, and this is the hard part, to a new business model. Perhaps the consequence is I need new sales channels, I need new salespeople, in order to even test these things and make sure that you can get the traction, you have to almost have those things in place. And that takes time, because I've been in the game for a while. When you're younger, your tendency is to, as you said, blame the salespeople, blame the business unit people. Why can't they see? Why are they not innovative? And it has nothing to do with that. Over time, you realize, okay, this is a systemic problem. That if we truly hope to solve this maturity gap, what I would call the corporate innovation gap, then we have to have a serious discussion all the way from strategy through organizational setup to ever have a chance of scaling. And I say often, everybody can get you to MVP. That's a commodity. You know it because consulting firms are offering it, right? So everybody can get you there. I have not yet seen anyone who knows how to solve this organizational problem.
If you think about one of the challenges, you mentioned this in this chapter, is that the organizations built around exploitation of an already current advantage, something that they've built up, some product they have that's been tried and tested. And then everybody at leadership levels also focused on that, because that's where their own remuneration is coming from. And I wonder this sometimes, to be able to zoom up a level as a leader and look down and go, oh, we need a totally different configuration or alignment of the organization in order to make this new business model work at all, is one huge restructuring of how I actually think as a leader. And if I do that, maybe I'll be less valuable inside the new organization. And that's a huge mental issue for people. But then I'd love you to riff on another one, which is, if I have a product, you mentioned Bosch and Mann and Hummel, I have a product that I'm known for that's successful. And then there's this product that is MVP, and it might mess with my existing brand, and it might affect the perception of that brand as well. They need to be broken out. They need to be introduced differently, which also means different salespeople.
That's right. And this calls into question, this is something when I was at Imperial College last fall that came up. It calls into question whether corporations, back to Clayton Christensen, can they even do this? Can they even do this type of innovation, and should they? And you're totally right that you might need to consider separating it from the existing brand, but here's why I ask the question, can corporates do this and should they do this type of innovation? If I separate it from the existing brand and I realize that I can't take advantage of the core, then I've taken away all of the reasons that it's advantageous to do innovation inside of a corporation, right? And I think you see a whole industry of venture builders that have arisen based on that theory. You, corporation, cannot solve this. Therefore, we're going to totally extract it from you, build it outside of your organization, and then try to test something there. I would call in the question why you do that too, because that seems to be a waste of corporate resources and the shareholders' money as well, if you're public or if you're private. cutting into your future R&D spend, right? So it's really difficult to sort this out. So I don't want to trivialize this. It sounds easy from our perspective to say, yeah, the leader just has to make this decision. I suspect those leaders also know the truth that the probability of that new business model working is super low, right? So they realize that if I commit to reorganizing my entire business model, just to test something that has a low probability of failure, maybe the right decision is to kill it. So then that comes to another discussion, but we need business model innovation. So how will we actually set that up? That's an open question in my mind. How we do that, how you do it correctly, and it may be something that's dependent on each business model out there. It may not be a common answer. I know us in the innovation space, we love to say, let's create an engine of innovation. They have to commit to creating the engine and the funnel, and then something will pop out. But you need a hell of a lot of resources to do that. And I think that's where they balk, right? That's where they hesitate, because you're asking me to commit to a system, to a funnel where the results are unknown up front. And if you're asking me to commit to a singular idea, I think the CEO's decision to shut that down is probably correct, because the probability of that having success with all the uncertainty still in it, that's part of the maturity gap, is very low.
It always reminds me of this Greek proverb that goes something like, a society grows great when old men plant trees under whose shade they'll never sit. So you're planting something now for the future. And that is a very human decision made by many leaders, is like, on things are going well. During my tenure, we can milk as much profit out of the existing business model. And it's like a sports team, right? You don't invest in the academy for the future. But you've seen organizations you've worked in. You've worked in Bosch, you've worked in the accelerator, you've driven that accelerator, you're doing it now in Mann and Hummel. Maybe we'll share what you're seeing from the positive side for those people working in this, to give them some encouragement.
What I've appreciated in both of those companies is we like to bash on leaders not doing these things that we're talking about. And it's by no means the case that any of the organizations that worked at have figured out the perfect model for how you scale innovation. They're in line with everyone else out there trying to figure this out. But the willingness to try it, and also on top, the courage to have the discussion that we have issues at scaling, doing self-reflection on that, trying new things. Because ultimately, I think the answer is something like, we like to, in our innovation space, latch on to the one thing we're trying. Like, you'll see UX people will latch on to design thinking, or business modeling people will latch on to lean startup, right? Or CVC people will latch on to startups are the only way to solve this, or M&As, you're all wrong, we just buy it, let them validate on the market. I think the answer is somewhere like allowing all of those experiments to take shape, because it's a numbers game and they're all just tools in one big innovation box, where we're all trying to find an answer to that scaling problem to bridge the gap. And in both of the companies that I've been at, there's been an open-mindedness around that to try it, to try things, knowing that it's difficult, knowing that other companies struggle with this too, and knowing and trusting that, yeah, I may not have the answer. It's clear I don't have the answer, but that we're searching for the answer. And the willingness to also say, we need new business models, look for them. But knowing it's not one tool that's going to win the game. So I've appreciated that at both companies, that they allow people like us, who are, I would argue, most people like us are deeply countercultural in the organizations we're in. So they allow you to pursue what I like to say, the truth, right? But do it in a way that's not necessarily congruent with their current culture. So they allow that experiment to run. That's already a big plus. And I have a faith that if we keep running these experiments, the probability suggests that sometime we'll figure this out.
Brilliant, man. I thought.
Otherwise, I'd be out of the game.
Actually, I think you're right. I always say on this show that I think that change makers, corporate explorers, whatever you want to call catalysts, they're neurodivergent. Like they don't, they're often identified by the corporate immune system as an outsider and attacked. But when leadership gives you air cover and protects you from that attack, you can make huge progress. And I love that, you know, you've seen this and you've experienced this, that you're given somewhat air cover, because it's often not the case. But one of the big problems, and we won't get into it today, but I'm sure you've experienced this, is that you can experience huge gaslighting by the organization to kind of go, oh no, you're wrong, you're crazy, this will never work, you're gonna damage the reputation of the company, etc. So that's maybe for another conversation, Michael, and happy for you to riff on that. But one thing I did want to get to our audience is indicators of business model maturity, to understand when some of the key success factors showing that you have a mature business model. At least people will take that away and just understand where things are going in the future. Maybe we'll give, there's eight in this chapter, there's loads in it, by the way, for our audience. I highly recommend checking out the book to check out that chapter. But maybe just share a couple of the key ones, Michael, as a parting thought for our audience.
So I'll talk through essentially what the criteria are. And these criteria are not rocket science. If you go into the VC world, you're going to see them. Every startup is exposed to these criteria, and they're going to sound like this. I'll tell it at a narrative level, and then I'll tell you why I think corporations struggle with it. So at a narrative level, you have to find a strong problem to solve in the world. And by strong problem, we mean really top of mind, a strong pain. Everybody says, yeah, that makes sense. But I will tell you, this thing is very rare to find. So we say must have need, extremely strong problem. And what do we mean by that? When somebody goes to sleep at night, it's the top three things in their mind that keep them awake at night. Not a nice to have, not, yeah, it sounds nice, not social desirability that you see with a lot of sustainability projects. We like it. And I come from American society. And I like it's not sufficient. Did you get a check for that? Did you get an order for that? It's really, there's a strong pull to solve this problem. There's no other way to solve it in the way that you're imagining. So I spend a lot of time on that because that's the biggest stumbling block of all. And if you look at postmortems on startups, they almost all always fail because there's not a strong enough market need. Because without that, the rest of what I'm going to say just will not appear. It's the first thing when we look at a maturity model, an assessment that we try to detect. The hard thing about it is it's very qualitative in the beginning. People often say, how do I know I have a strong problem? And the answer is like a lawyer answer. You'll know when you find it. You'll know when they're pulling. And I say they, it's got to be more than one. It's got to be repeatable. So the problem in the problem, it's got to be severe enough and repeatable enough that your future scale is already built into it. If you were to solve it, it would automatically find scale. Okay? So you're already thinking forward on the problem. Then it's understand who has that problem. Who is it? What is this customer segment? It already starts there. Are there enough of these people, right? So it's the repeatability problem, repeatability of the segment. Does it differ every time they have the problem, right? Are they, so you're thinking again, afford to scale. You're going to hear and repeatability. So this is the common theme behind all of this. Is it, if you're in a corporation, is it a regional problem or is it a global problem? So you're thinking through that. And the VC world is the same because they're thinking forward to the exit. It has to be big enough to justify such an IPO or an exit to a company, a global company. So we spend an inordinate amount of time looking at customer problem and repeatability. Now, if you get that, notice I have not mentioned technology yet, because it's irrelevant to this point. If you get that, then you start asking yourself, almost simultaneously, do we as a company or as a venture, do we even have access to this customer? Do they have budget? Because it does good if there's a strong problem and repeatable, but they don't have the money to solve it. Okay, so then you go from there. okay, they seem to have a budget. We would have a channel to them. And if we don't, we have to figure out a business model for that. Then you start thinking, okay, can I solve this problem with our capabilities as a company? Can we solve it? Can we do it in a repeatable fashion? Now we're talking tech scalability, right? Can we produce the value proposition? Is it a value proposition that's 10x better than any other solution they have, including doing nothing? Which we often forget. We tend to classify our competition in terms of the very myopic technical thing we're doing. Competition goes back to the problem definition, which includes doing nothing at all, right? So you have to think of competition in that sense as well, very broadly. So you do that, and now we've gotten you to MVP, which I said everybody can do. But getting an MVP that really has that strong customer pull, that's already rare when you have it, but it's very qualitative. And then the next part is, and this is the hardest part, go from MVP with a few customers that are representative of a larger scalable segment to scale the sales. This part is always underestimated. As one of my venture principal says, she says, it always takes twice as long and costs twice as much as you think it will. And so if that's the sticking point, that's where the maturity gap is in the venture world. It's called the valley of death. It's the same thing, same concept. Getting to there and figuring out how to do repeatable sales, that's the trick. That's where we're looking at stickiness. We're looking at the scalability of the sales, right? Repeatability of the sales model. I would argue if you could get there, you have a repeatable sales model, the corporation from there could take it. Now it's ready. Now it's ready to scale. But getting there is really the problem. So I've set it at a narrative level. And I think you've heard in my description, one of the reasons we struggle so badly in corporate is we want to put metrics on that. We want to put quantitative KPIs around that. And I'm suggesting in those criteria that at least half of what I said is qualitative. And do not underestimate the qualitative proof, the qualitative evidence, because that's really what drives whether you have that must-have or not. So I think business in that sense is a social science, right? So it's very much about understanding customer behaviors, understanding what drives them to solve problems, the urgency of solving problems. And then the other part is building a solution that creates value. Value by itself is a qualitative concept. We often try to make it quantitatively understandable. We do that later. But corporates, I think, struggle because those early business cases to a CFO sound like utter nonsense. Show me your five-year plan. Show me your EBIT, your revenue targets. And you're saying, I could give you those, but the certainty around those is really small. And we can only get more certainty as we do those steps that I just mentioned. So I think of it as you're building the evidence, often highly qualitative up front, for what eventually goes into a projected P&L with a net present value calculation. But that evidence you're building gives me the confidence that what I put in that Excel sheet is actually real. So that's how people work in venture capital. It's really a lot of thumb in the air. You hate to say it, but it's, and that's what makes, I think, corporate executives feel uncomfortable with it, is that this early stage is so qualitative. There's so much uncertainty. And I'm also telling you, you don't know it till you have it. You don't know it till you have it because you feel the pull from the market, that traction that everyone harps on when we're in the venture capital world. I spend most of my time in the chapter trying to explain what's meant by those terms. But really what's behind it is not rocket science. Found a repeatable severe problem, the customer segment that is big enough to justify an investment, that you have access to and they have budget, that you can solve and create a value proposition that matters, and then find a repeatable sales model on top of it. And that's it, but it's so damn hard to find. I'm just going to leave it there.
I just imagine having that conversation with a CFO who's not trained in this and how difficult that would be, because they are, and I think this is the empathy that comes from doing this work, is that CFO, he or she is trained for exploitation. And when you're working in this work, you are wired for exploration, and they're totally different wirings.
I feel like if I had to criticize our side, we should be able to put together models for CFOs that explain it. And I think it is understandable if you just use probabilities, you can model things out. And then as you get closer to MVP stage, you should absolutely have a financial model ready to go at that point. So sometimes I think we come across as just finding excuses not to commit to the numbers like they do in the core. It's just a different business case, right? In the end, it's not what they're used to, but I think you can absolutely build a business case they can understand by using some probability-based models, right? Expected value models, and then showing them with these criteria, actually the discount rate should fall as you validate, right? That's the whole point of the validation and the model, is that you're saying, yeah, when it's an idea, discount rate should be 80%, but as you get to MVP, we're getting closer to 40. When we found that repeatable sales model, now we're at about 25% discount rate. And if we would learn to speak that language, I think CFOs would get it a lot better. So that's on us too.
Absolutely.
To improve our margin, right?
It's difficult to do as well because it's not fun, most of that work. Michael, for people who want to find you, I'm sure loads of our audience want to reach out to you. Where's the best place?
I'm highly responsive on LinkedIn. So find me on LinkedIn and we can provide a link, I think, afterwards down below. You'll have my profile. I'm a person that's very open to any kind of conversations. You have to be a learner in this space. So if you want to come, challenge anything I said, that's also good. If you want to ask questions, also good. Or just shoot the breeze when it comes to innovation, always good.
Director of Corporate Ventures for Mann and Hummel, Michael Nichols, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
As always, the Corporate Explorer series is brought to you by Wazoku. Wazoku helps large organizations create effective, sustainable innovation ecosystems that accelerate efficiency gains and new value growth. It does this through intelligent enterprise software that connects and harnesses the power of employees, suppliers, startups, universities, and the unique Wazoku crowd of 700,000 plus global problem solvers. Wazoku calls this connected collective intelligence. You can find Wazoku at wazoku.com. See you soon.